If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. Again, this call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. If you would like to speak, you can virtually raise your hand by pressing five star on your dial pad. You will then be called upon in the order that your hand was raised. Again, that's five star. Please take a moment to enter your speaker code if you've not already done so. Please remember to mute your phones until speaking. Again, please enter your speaker code now if you haven't already done so. Good afternoon and welcome to a duly noticed meeting for the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. The Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery was created when Governor Sununu issued Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the Governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the Board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Today's meeting is also being recorded. I will help facilitate today's meeting. Because the Board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need before I can turn it over to our Chair, Donnelly Loza. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us. As we move through our agenda today, each Board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call. Starting with the attendance for roll call, I'll begin with the format. I am Joe Dorian, Deputy Director of the Gopher in the Gopher Office, One Eagle Square in Concord. I am joined by
Lisa English,
Nancy Smith,
Wendy Gilman,
Rhonda Hensley.
And we are all appropriately socially distanced at a large conference room at BEA. Proceeding down the Board member list, Bill Ardinger.
Yes, thank you, Joe. This is Bill Ardinger. I'm at my home in Concord. In the house with me is my wife, my daughter, and my two-and-a-half-year-old grandson, whom you may hear if I'm not careful. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Dean Kristen.
Good afternoon, Joe. This is Dean Kristen, Executive Director of New Hampshire Housing. I'm at the authority's offices in Bedford, and I am alone.
Thank you, Dean. Jim Jalbert.
Good afternoon, Joe. This is Jim Jalbert from C&J Bus Lines. I am at my office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Jim. Amy LaBelle. And just Amy, if maybe if you're muted, but I also believe that I thought I heard mentioned that you wouldn't be able to make it. So just I will come back to you at the end of the roll call just to double check. Al Letizio Jr.
Good afternoon, Joe. Good afternoon, Board. This is Al Letizio Jr. I'm CEO of AJ Letizio Sales and Marketing of Windham, New Hampshire. Today I am working from an office in Charlestown, Massachusetts, and I am alone.
Thank you, Al. Donnelly Lozo.
Afternoon, Joe. This is Donnelly Lozo, and I'm here in Manchester in my office, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Donnelly. Scott Mason.
This is Scott Mason. I'm in my car, Route 93, somewhere north of Concord.
Thank you, Scott. Michelle McEwen.
Good afternoon. This is Michelle McEwen. I'm in my office at Speer Memorial Hospital in Plymouth, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Michelle. Jeffrey Myers.
Good afternoon, Joe. I am in my home in Concord. There is no one else at home now.
Great.
Good to be
thank
here.
Thank you, Jeff. Awesome. Thank you. Nancy Merrill.
Yes, hi. This is Nancy Merrill, and I am working from my office in Claremont, and I am alone.
Thank you, Nancy. Holly Noveletsky.
Good afternoon. This is Holly Noveletsky. I'm at my office at Novel Ion in Greenland, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Holly. Kathleen Reardon.
Hi there. This is Kathleen Reardon. I'm in my home in New Boston. My husband's in the home, but in another room.
Thank you, Kathleen. Benjamin Wilcox.
Hi, this is Ben Wilcox. I'm in North Conway at Cranmore Mountain, and I am in my office by myself.
Thank you, Ben. Commissioner Myers, if you wouldn't mind pressing 5-star for us, please. We're just trying to populate the speaker window. Additionally, any of the presenters, if you could do the same, that would be helpful to us. But just finishing up the roll call, Amy LaBelle, did you by chance join us?
Joe, can you hear me now?
I can.
Wonderful. It's Amy LaBelle. I'm in my home office alone.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Donna Lee, with the roll call completed, we have all members present.
Great. Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you, everybody, for making arrangements to try to make this work today. The next item on our agenda is a presentation from Gopher, and we begin with Attorney Nancy Smith. Floor is yours.
Good afternoon. I'm Nancy Smith. I'm now General Counsel here at Gopher on a loan from the Department of Justice. What I thought I would do first is talk about the requirements that are in the CARES Act itself, because the Treasury guidance can't contradict those requirements. It can only build on them and explain them. Then talk about the Treasury guidance and then talk about some examples. So the CARES Act itself regarding the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which is this $1.25 billion, it's hard to say that, has some really foundational requirements for what we're allowed to use the funds for. They have to be for necessary expenditures that were incurred due to the COVID state of emergency. And they can only be used for costs that were incurred during the period that begins on March 1st, 2020 and ends on December 30th, 2020. The other one that is more applicable to government than to what might impact other types of recipients of these funds is that the expenditures or expenses that are being reimbursed or covered cannot have been in the budget that is currently in effect. So the Department of Treasury is charged with enforcing these restrictions, and the statute itself requires the Department of Treasury to recoup funds from the state if funds are determined to have been improperly used. Any funds, and it also provides that any funds that are not expended on an allowable use within the time period have to be returned to the federal government. The CARES Act itself does not contain any exemption from the general federal grant compliance requirements that are found in 2 CFR 200. It does contain a provision almost at the end of the act that generally says that the funds available under this act may only be used in a manner that's consistent with other general federal guidelines, which would certainly indicate that 2 CFR 200 applies. And other guidance regarding spending on other parts of the Act have also mentioned that those general compliance requirements will apply. So one thing we need to keep in mind on for recipients is that our agreements and documentation and support for spending the money will need to be in compliance with those federal requirements, and those could include for large recipients having a single federal audit And they could also include other types of documentation being needed. Moving on to the guidance itself, as you, I'm sure, have noticed, it was remarkably short for anything written by the federal government, but it does contain a few key points. They did give some explanation of what necessary expenditures means. And they indicated that for state and local government, it's actions taken to respond to the public health emergency or expenditures on what they call second order effects of the public health emergency, which are economic losses for individuals and businesses. One thing that's important for us is that they did indicate that they will use a fairly lenient standard in determining whether something was necessary. It's basically the reasonable judgment of the government official responsible for approving the expenditure. So that is that's very good from our point of view because it does indicate a fairly deferential standard will be applied. The requirement that costs not have been accounted for in the budget means that it can't lawfully be funded from a current line item in the budget or that it's used being or that it's for a substantially different use than the funds were initially allocated. And that provision may give us some leeway in addressing some costs of government because it might allow for reimbursement if, for example, staff have been repurposed from what they were originally supposed to do to responding to the COVID crisis. But one final point on that is that cost is only incurred when the responsible unit of government, which in this case would be the state since we are the recipient of the funds, has expended the funds to cover costs during the period from March 1 to December 30th, which absent further clarification, such as a specifying a closeout period, would indicate that we have to have the funds expended by December 30th. So one of the things that the Treasury guidance was fairly clear on is that the allowable unit uses does not include making up shortfalls in government revenue. For either state or local government. I do understand that there are discussions ongoing about that, but that is the current guidance from Treasury. So moving on to some examples, allowable expenditures all of these would be subject to the requirement that they cannot have been reimbursed from any other federal source. So that would mean that to the extent that local government or the state government has obtained reimbursement from FEMA for some expenses, those could not also be reimbursed from these funds. Similarly, for businesses, if they have received money from the PPP program to pay their employees, then they couldn't, again, try and obtain the payments made for payroll during this time period from these funds. So that wouldn't be an allowable expenditure that we could cover. But we can consider provision of grants to businesses or nonprofits to reimburse costs of business interruptions, including revenue replacement, acquiring protective equipment, needed in order to reopen, addressing supply chain issues, and things like technological investments that might be necessary to improve their online capability. We believe those are all allowable to fit into the second order economic support category. We could also consider payments to individuals under a state payroll support program, and we could consider unemployment insurance costs that are not reimbursed by some other federal program. So those are the main categories for businesses or nonprofits. The rest of the examples the guidance talks about are really aimed more at public entities, local government, county government, or state government, and they include medical expenses, costs for establishing surge facilities, public health expenses such as the testing, costs for involved in isolation and quarantine, obtaining protective supplies. A lot of government offices and businesses have engaged in additional cleaning to protect government workers. Those types of things that are directly related to responding to the COVID crisis would be eligible, as long as, again, they haven't been covered by some other program. There is a provision in the guidance that says that public entity payroll expenses could be covered for public safety, health, and similar employees who are substantially dedicated to responding to the COVID crisis. That would seem to somewhat be inconsistent with a provision that you can't cover things that are currently in your budget because those employees are already in the budget, but I think that is allowable under the definition of that goes back to what costs are not accounted in the budget, that if an employee has been repurposed from what they would normally do to responding to the COVID crisis, then they are giving us a little bit of wiggle room that those payroll costs might be allowable for government. The final category is kind of a catch-all, that government expenses, which would include covering expenditures from local government, not local government, from private businesses and nonprofits or local government that don't otherwise fit within these examples, as long as they fall within the other criteria of the statute. So that's kind of just a catch-all. But the non-allowable actually, let me just cover one more thing under that. So an example of one thing that we might be able to do, even though we can't do revenue shortfalls for local government, if they have to get tax anticipation notes, TANs, which some of them sometimes do to cover delinquencies in taxes, then, and that has increased due to COVID, we could at least cover the interest and expense on that borrowing so that it wouldn't cost them money to get those tax anticipation notes if they need them. Moving on to non-allowable costs, again, and the Treasury does make a point of emphasizing this several times. It can't be for expenditures that are reimbursed from any other source, such as the PPP program, FEMA, CDC, or other sections of the CARES Act. So we are going to have to be aware of what recipients or people requesting aid get from any other source. We can't cover the state share on certain types of reimbursement or federal funds. The most significant of that may be the FEMA reimbursement, which would also cover a lot of the types of expenses that are eligible here. FEMA is a separate pot of money, but it's at 75%. And it does, under the Stafford Act, require a 25% state share. And at this time, unless something changes, we can't make up the state share with other federal funds, similar to increased COVID expenses in the Medicaid program. Medicaid requires a state share, so we can't make up the state share of Medicaid from the CARES Act funds. The business losses that are not directly related to COVID or that occur outside the period, so we need to be careful and be sure that the losses are COVID-related, not related to a faulty or poor business model that was resulting in losses anyway. We can't pay employee bonuses, although we could pay hazard pay. We also cannot, we also need to be careful that the funds are being dispersed to cover allowable costs during the period. And I understand that loans have been discussed, and there is a big question as to whether what would have to happen with the principal being paid back on those loans, even if they were 0% interest. It's our understanding that the principal would have to go back into the program from which they came and be subject to the same restriction, so that the principal could only be used to cover costs that were incurred during this time period related to the COVID crisis. So that is likely subject to obtaining further guidance to be a limitation on using loans rather than grants. And the guidance only mentions grants. It never mentions loans. So I mentioned a couple times that we could benefit from further guidance on a couple areas that hasn't been forthcoming yet. The Act establishes a Pandemic Accountability Committee, which is comprised of all the inspector generals of all the agencies charged with distributing money. They just got their website launched yesterday. It has links to all the various federal agencies, but all that is on those is the guidance that we already got from Treasury. This Pandemic Accountability Committee is supposed to come up with a strategic plan. Their website says that's under development. The CARES Act does say that this Pandemic Accountability Committee is charged with monitoring and auditing to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. And so it does indicate that the federal government is going to be looking at how these funds are used and holding states and recipients to compliance. Any questions?
Wow. I'm not sure exactly where questions might begin. Much of what you provided, Attorney Smith, had a government focus. I think our group is trying to wear business hats and stakeholder groups hats, so I think we might have to process some of it. If there are questions, we can certainly take them. I'm conscious of keeping us on schedule today with our presenters on the phone, and I wanted to make sure if Lisa English wants to present next, and then we can come back to questions for the two of you, because maybe things might be a little easier that way. But if, Joe, if there are hands raised, by all means, please recognize folks.
Yep. We have a hand raised real fast, Donnelly, from Bill Ardinger.
Okay. Bill.
Donnelly and Joe, thank you. I think I'm going to defer my question per what Donnelly just said. It may not be appropriate given our timing today, and I think Attorney Smith laid out a lot of good points that require follow-up. So thank you.
Great. Donnelly, is it okay if Lisa proceeds with her update?
Yes, please.
Excellent. Thank you. So we spoke last week about the various federal funds, and I was asked to give just a little bit more context about why that's important and some of the other mechanisms that have brought funding to New Hampshire. So our collective mission here is related to the Coronavirus Relief Fund, and that's the $1.25 billion that Nancy Smith was talking about when she was describing the guidance. The reason we took time to talk about the other COVID-related federal funds is it helps us to understand what other opportunities are available. And as we analyze how to best use the funds, understanding if there's some mechanism to get funding to a particular industry, that may mean the urgent need is taken care of. It may mean part of the total need is taken care of. So understanding that is certainly helpful. I'm sure all of you are aware that on Friday, the Payment Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act was signed into law, which provides some additional funds to the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund, as well as some funding for COVID-19 testing. So I will provide an updated chart over the next several days or perhaps a week as we continue to populate the different buckets of funding. Some of the earlier federal efforts we didn't really talk a lot about. So just very quickly, there have been four legislative efforts to date related to the public health emergency. The first one was back in early March, the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act. And I'm not going to go through everything that each one of these have done, but that one provided some CDC funding to states. It had other changes, for example, the federal HHS provided a mechanism to allow for expanded telehealth during emergencies. The next action was on March 18th, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. That one had a lot of funding in it. There was increased funding for the school lunch program. There were changes made to programs such as WIC to respond to some of the social distancing measures. There was an increased SNAP flexibilities during an emergency. This is where we saw some enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, and that's where there was a temporary increase of the federal match for most Medicaid spending, which is to the benefit of states. What we talked about last week was primarily out of the March 27th CARES Act, which is otherwise known as, everyone calls it the CARES Act, but it is the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. And then finally, the legislation passed last week was the Payment Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act. So the other question that was raised to me was, is there a difference between this $1.25 billion that we are here talking about and stimulus? And so the easy answer is yes, this is described as a relief fund. As opposed to stimulus funds. But there isn't a bright line. I'm sure you have all seen in the media, there's discussion that there may be a CARES 4.0 and that there may be a stimulus package. But we don't know that right now. And here, as Nancy talked about, this is a relief package that's very much focused on what are the losses that have been incurred because of the COVID-19 public health emergency. So that's my really quick overview of sort of the legislative context coming out of the federal government and things that we're looking for. But I'm happy to take any questions. And if there's other information that you would like us to dig into, you know, please let us know.
Thank you, Lisa. And thank you, Attorney Smith. I didn't mean to diminish all of the information you provided. I simply meant to explain that it was quite a bit. Lisa, very helpful to break it into those sections, I think, because I'm getting similar questions, and I'm sure members of the board are as well. It would be helpful if we could get maybe a simple double-sided document that just laid out the four legislative actions that you just described and the difference between relief versus stimulus. And then that work that you're doing, I know that it's not ready for prime time yet, but what you're, the work that you're doing trying to determine what money might already be available in different places so that the board members might be able to review it and help us to focus some of our efforts appropriately. If there are questions, though, we're happy to take them. And, Lisa, I didn't mean to cut you off. I can't see you.
Oh, no. You knew I was going to say happy to do it.
Thank you. Board members, anybody have any questions?
And if so, please press 5-star on your dial pad and aggregate some questions. Anybody? Donnelly, there doesn't seem to be any questions, so I guess Attorney Smith and Lisa English did just such a great explanation of everything. So if you would
indulge me.
Let's go with that. So just a quick announcement. We're very excited. And just another update from the Gopher office. We're very excited that our website is live. That is up. For members of the public, you can find today's agenda. Also, the documents that folks will be referencing attached to the website, along with a list of speakers that we have scheduled here this afternoon. So just for ease of following along and transparency, we're very happy that that's live. A lot of this stuff has been on the other Gopher page, but I think it's a little bit easier to find now, and we appreciate a lot of feedback that we've gotten from folks. So we're really happy about that. So I'd encourage you to take a look, and it's very exciting. So it's up and running.
Where would they find that, Joe? Where would they find it?
So
what's the address?
www.gopher.nh.gov is the main page. So gopher.nh.gov, our acronym here. And then if you go to the Stakeholder Advisory Board, you'll find a list of all the members of the Stakeholder Advisory Board, the public call-in and PIN number, so members of the public can see when the meetings are scheduled. We have meetings at Tuesday at 1 p.m., Thursday at 2 o'clock p.m., as I mentioned, the members. If you go into the Public Meetings, that tab, and scroll down, you'll find meetings, public announcements. So there's it's very interactive and informative. For members of the public, under the Advisory Board tab, if you click on Advisory Board Presentations and scroll to the bottom, you'll see the most recent meetings are at the bottom of the page. Again, that's on the main page. If you click Advisory Board tab, Advisory Board Presentations, scroll to the bottom, and you'll find today's presentations that will be referenced there, and again with a list of the speakers. So hopefully it's easy for folks to follow, a little easier for folks to follow along now, and we'll be updating that. So when we're bugging board members for names and stuff, that's where this stuff is going.
Great. It looks terrific. Thank you so much, Joe.
No problem. It was a great team effort, and Kate, who's sitting across from me, put a lot of work into it in Department of Information Technology. So we're a great team effort.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate it. It also gives our members a place to let people know where to go to look for information. Because our testimony is coming in fast and furious, and with that, if the board is ready, we'd like to introduce Patricia Lynch, the executive director of the Music Hall. Her contact from the board is Jim Jalbert, who will lead any questions after her presentation.
Great. Thank you very much for having me today. I appreciate
Most
it.
Welcome.
I appreciate all the work that you're doing. I'm from the music hall. Yes, I've been the executive director there for 15 plus years. I've seen it grow from a $1.7 million organization to a $6 million annual budget. We are the largest performing arts center in New Hampshire. We have two venues. We do 600 events annually. We've been nationally recognized by media outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Yankee Magazine, and others. We employ in a full season 65 people. We have 350 volunteers who look to us for community connection. We have 130,000 people who attend the music hall on a year-round basis, 12 months a year. Additionally, there are 10,000 children who also see oftentimes their very first performing arts experience at the music hall. These are highly subsidized events. And the loss of COVID, the losses that we've experienced because of COVID are devastating. We expect to have losses of over $1.5 million. Now, we have a very talented staff, talented professional staff, and we have a invested and wise board. Our artists come to us that are world known, whether it be Doris Kearns Goodwin and Dan Brown in literary events, or Lyle Lovett, Melissa Etheridge, or our beloved Holiday Musical. But we've had a balanced budget for over 10 years. Our last, we have a successful business model. We plan for rainy days, but there is no way that we could have been fully prepared for an event like COVID-19. Now, we are part of what makes the Seacoast hum. When we hum, downtown businesses hum. 30 restaurants are in our immediate proximity. They hang our event calendar in their kitchens so they can figure out how to staff their restaurants. People, we provide $9 million annually in show-related expenses, show-related spending, whether it's people coming to restaurants or to shop or to park when they come to see an event at the music hall. Additionally, CEOs from around the state have told me personally that we are part of their recipe for attracting creative, educated workforce and having them be happy to live, play, and work in New Hampshire. With the loss of $1.5 million, of course, we're doing everything we can. We've cut costs where we can. We have received $319,000 in the Payroll Protection Act. But this, again, will not make up the revenue replacement that we're going to be missing. Our donors, who are very loyal, have stepped up to try and mitigate our effects. But we need help. The arts sector will need help. And otherwise, if we don't come back a year from now, 9 months from now, come and rev back up, it will have a chilling effect on Portsmouth and the seacoast, because we, as have been described again and again, as an anchor and an economic driver. So I thank you for your kind attention, and I'm willing to take questions.
Thank you very much.
So this is Jim Jalbert. Yes. Patricia, first of all, thank you for coming. Patricia, let me start off with a couple of things. Prior to COVID-19, what would you have described as the financial position of the music hall moving forward for 2020?
Outstanding. We were having a great year, and we had one of the busiest spring and summer seasons booked that we had seen in a number of years. We were charging on all cylinders.
And what was your what was it, if you take the and just for a little background, why don't you describe to our committee what the two components of are of the music hall, both the loft and the old theater, and then talk about what happens at each location before I ask the next question.
Absolutely. The historic theater is a 900-seat venue. It has been beautifully restored. Millions of dollars have gone into this, and it is a showpiece recognized around the country. The loft is the smaller black box theater, 124 seats. We show films and have live events in both venues. We feature a big Broadway-style musical at the holidays. We have a partnership with New Hampshire Public Radio for the nationally acclaimed Writers on a New England Stage, which is done in the historic theater, but we also have literary events in the smaller theater. We are the home of several large film festivals, including the New Hampshire Film Festival and Telluride by the Sea. So those use both venues. 600 events happen at the music hall in a full season using both venues.
And my follow-up to that is, out of all the, as we all know, and full disclosure, everybody, I attend the music hall. A lot of people in the seacoast of New Hampshire go to the music hall. Probably many of you who are here on the call today have done that. How much have you had to do in terms of refunds back to the public as a result of the impact of COVID-19? And what does that cost the music hall just in the last couple of months?
Last couple of months, we've had to make refunds of well over $100,000 as we struggle to reschedule shows. Now, those refunds, we're working with artists actively, but those are just the tickets that had been sold up to that point. If you look at our overall capacity, Jim, we've been running at an 82% capacity. We don't see any way that we will, for the next 9 months, that we will do more than 50%. That is a huge loss of revenue.
So I'm going to stop there and see if anybody else in the committee wants to ask any questions of Patricia.
Joe, any hands up?
Donnelly, we have a hand up from Bill Ardinger.
Thank you. Bill?
Yes. Thank you, Donnelly, and thank you very much for your presentation and your written comments. The music hall's comments, as well as many of the people who are also speaking today to us, were exceptionally good, clear, provided a real guidance and record that let me kind of get to know some of the pressure that's on your organization. So I thank you for taking the time to do that and to address those guidelines. With respect to your description of the impact, it's clear that the impact, that even though you're a nonprofit organization, you file a Form 990 as, you know, a nonprofit tax-exempt, federally tax-exempt organization, you are suffering from substantial employment and business interruption as a result of COVID-19. And Attorney Smith, who presented earlier, pointed to the Treasury guidance, which clearly said that the funds can be used to address those important effects to provide economic support to those who are suffering, those organizations, enterprises, people suffering from unemployment or business interruptions. My question to you is, in your presentation, you identified a one-time award of relief funds in the amount of $250,000, which, by the way, again, thank you for the precision. None of the members of this committee, nor the, more importantly, the Gopher staff, have as much time as they would like to get to possible uses of funds. Your attempt to try and provide us with a tangible, real request moves the ball way down the road. I wanted to say, what do you think those dollars, that if a grant were made by either directly by the governor's office or indirectly through another agency who might have received a grant from the governor's office, what would you see those funds being used and expended on?
Thank you, Bill. That's an excellent question. We asked for $250K first because we wanted to be respectful. While we expect losses of over $1.5 million, on this significant business operation, we are fully aware that these funds will be needed by many people. So we'll be working every way we can to mitigate our losses. But this will be an important piece. We expect that this will be used to help us sustain ourselves in this time of extreme business interruption and help us make this revenue replacement. We are going to have some additional, you know, cleaning, staffing costs when we reopen for mitigation efforts. We're going to these artists, these world-class artists, they have so many invitations to go to so many places, even now, that they have no motivation to cut their fees. Their expenses remain what they are. So we are going to, in order to get back up and humming, and therefore to be an economic driver for the region, we're going to need to employ our business model that has worked so successfully for not just ourselves, but the entire larger region and the state. So these will go for really revenue replacement so that we can keep the engine running, because I can honestly say to you, this is no shine whatsoever, that when we hum, the region hums. We are part of that essential mix. And when we create jobs because other businesses are humming on the activity that we create, we're making sure that those people then don't have to rely on human services as much or at all.
Wonderful answer, and it's about economic support is what you'd be using it for. And I thank you for your answer, and I don't want to take away from anyone else. So thank you very much, Donna Lee and Joe, for letting me ask the question.
Thank you, Bill. I'm conscious of the time. We're trying to make sure that each presenter has about a 15-minute block to present and respond to questions. We have about a minute left. And if there is another question, we'll take it. And if not, we'll give you an opportunity, Patricia, to wrap up. Any last thoughts that you might have?
Donnelly, this is Joe. We currently don't have any hands raised.
Great. So, Patricia, if you would like to wrap up any comments, we're happy to hear them.
Thank you. First, I want you to know I really appreciate your time and all the work that you're doing. This is a great example of community coming together. The music hall is a great economic driver, but it is also a balm to people's spirits. Our volunteers rely on us for a place to come and be part of something. Those 350 people and our 65 employees rely on us, but all the employees of the businesses that we support also rely on us. I think that this is an opportunity for us to not just show what an economic driver we are, but also that we are a place that binds spirits together and a place that can be of hope and healing. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your time. With that, we will open up to John Tinos. I hope I pronounced that correctly, from the Tinos Pro Hospitality Group. Amy LaBelle was his contact, so when Joe finishes his presentation, Amy can open with any questions she has. We'll try to follow the same format. John? Joe, is John on the line?
I am.
Here we go.
All right, great. Thank you.
Okay, so this is John Tinos. I'm the president of Tinos Pro Hospitality Group. Our business is hospitality, obviously, and we have 5 restaurants, in addition, another small cafe within a restaurant, and a commissary which does all of our baking for all of our operations and some other outlets that both restaurants and kind of like high-end grocery stores that we also deliver to. I want to start first by thanking everybody for being able to speak on behalf of the hospitality businesses. We have been extremely... Did I lose everybody? Hello?
No, we can hear you.
We can hear you, John.
Got it. Okay, good, good, because my phone just seemed to go dead. So where we are right now is an industry is probably the darkest days that we've seen since really the Depression. Restaurants are closing. I think the latest figure that I heard was about 10,000 restaurants have already closed their doors permanently. In April, they're estimating that another 30,000 could close their doors permanently across the country. And I know that in this state, many of my peers have already closed. It really, it's really kind of been a wake-up call for us. We're, you know, now in our 50th year at the Galley Hatch restaurant. That's our oldest restaurant. Tinos, which is our Mediterranean restaurant, more of a high-end fine dining experience. But I've also got a golf course restaurant called Grill 28 at Pease International Trade Port. Portsmouth also has popovers on the square, and I can tell you that you listen to Patricia. She's right. Every time that there's a film festival, there's a show in Portsmouth. We benefit greatly. We're only like a 2-minute, 3-minute walk from the theater, and it's It's a great partnership for us. We've supported them. We've sponsored. I think that it can't be underestimated what that theater does in terms of the room and meals tax revenue that's generated from all the restaurants and from the hotels in Portsmouth and even in the surrounding community. So I think that's another positive for them. Our industry right now, and I hear so many different stories. I was on a call today with the self-funded workers' compensation of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. And we were talking about how we can basically give our members a break for April, May, and possibly even June, not paying their, monthly installments for workers' comp. And I heard a lot of, a lot of discussion about, well, what's going to happen if, we don't come up with enough money to cover us by, the state. There was a lot of discussion around, okay, our place is going to be, 50% occupied when they do open. Right now, there's minimal takeout going on in the state. Out of my six places, we're the only one that's doing takeout at the Galley Hatch and Tino's. We're all in the same building. 370 employees combined when we're all open and clicking. 40 are now currently working. Toughest day in my life was furloughing 320 employees. We're looking at, the state guidance, federal guidance, local government guidance, Chamber of Commerce task forces, beach task forces, other tourism representatives, and we're trying to come up with some kind of estimate of what this is going to be like when we actually do open up. Right now, this probably our business is probably generating less than 10% of what we'd normally generate in the state. Some of the estimates that I'm hearing that we could be affected by as much as 60 to 70% this year. That's significant, obviously. Just flipping a page here. Along with everything else, there's going to be a tremendous amount of unpredictability of the market. Nobody knows, with the fear factor of people going back into restaurants, exactly what's going to happen. I think the tourism industry as a whole in the state parks to event type of like the music hall and others are going to be obviously affected. Any large group gatherings, I know, for example, we had booked over 55 events at our Pease golf course, and I think we have 15 left that haven't canceled. So that's just the tip of the iceberg there. To date, two of our businesses have received the payroll protection plan out of the six. Still awaiting, we've been approved, bank approved, and awaiting funding numbers from the others. We also have gotten disaster relief in the form of $10,000 grants for three of our businesses. And I applied for a bridge loan, which I'm closing on tomorrow, reopening up our popovers so we can inventory them. I'd say that, why is the hospitality, industry valuable to, we are a top employer in the state of New Hampshire. In addition to providing jobs, we contribute by way of the rooms and meals tax, property taxes, local and state fees, specific to the restaurant industry as well as other feeder industries that pay taxes. You know, we support, you know, our restaurants and hotels across the state really do are great supporters of charities in their communities. We support education, athletics, arts, feeding the hungry and homeless. You know, giving really is what we do in the hospitality industry. You know, our margin for error is small, but our hearts are big. And I think we make a huge difference in our communities. You know, as Patricia said, you know, we are a asset for state expansion of businesses. Businesses want to, you know, especially their home headquarters and manufacturing, they want to expand somewhere where there are leisure activities to enjoy, great places to go out and dine, meet clients, have group functions, and just enjoy the lifestyle of this great state because there's so much to do here. You know, a sound hospitality industry is what draws businesses. And for these reasons, the state really needs to step up and contribute to our industry because we need to come back and we need to be there for everyone to start back in normal operations and give the state the boost, not only economically but psychologically. The payroll protection plan has been detailed today. Has some value to our industry, but not what it could. As you know, when we do open up, we're going to probably be at 50% or less of capacity. That may not happen. A lot of us have got funded already. That may not happen till 6-8 weeks after we actually get funded, which, you know, may only give us a couple of weeks of payroll protection that could be forgiven. This needs an extension. There's no question about it. For our industry, it kind of can be almost meaningless if we don't get extended. If we don't get extended, then we have a loan that we have to pay back in a matter of 2 years. And that will be an extra hardship for some of the businesses that may have trouble even making it to that point. The 25% that can be used for utilities, interest on loans, for mortgages and or rent, that's good, but doesn't anywhere near come to covering our other overheads. A lot of people have expanded, have mortgages, have loans that, you know, basically where they have created equipment. These aren't going to be funded in that PPP. And there's all kinds of other overhead expenses, liability insurance, workers' comp, existing, you know, mortgage payments, paying vendors, restocking our inventory. It just goes on and on and on. Funds are deposited into a separate fund only for the uses of payroll for employees and overhead. As an owner, I cannot take a bonus, and I cannot do this for any other foreign reason. I've talked to many of my friends, specifically a group that I just met with is on Hampton Beach. And can you imagine how they're feeling right now? Where they're very seasonal. They make the 90% of their money in 3 months. And a lot of them are not going to even be able to open their doors this year. That's definitely going to have a ripple effect on all of us in the Seacoast. So it's just another part of the puzzle. And this puzzle keeps continuing to grow. Now, I will tell you that in our business, we were on pace to have the best year we ever had since, you know, we've been open. This past year, our sales were up across the board about 12%. In some of our businesses, we were up as high as 25, 26%. We were excited going into this year. January and February were equally as busy. We were looking at another double-digit increase for 2020. Personally affected me and my fiance because we were going to get married in Greece in June. That isn't going to happen. I know a lot of other people that have, you know, planned vacations and have planned to do something. It's not happening for them either. So the beach, you know, trying to figure out how they're going to reopen and all the difficulties that they're going to have to get to that point. There's only so much physical separation, distancing, let alone social distancing. And this isn't an industry where social distancing is really our thing. You know, what
John,
we do, what we,
John?
Yes, yeah.
I hate to jump in, but each presenter only has 15 minutes today, and you have 1 minute left, and I know that
okay,
you
good.
Would love to take any questions.
Yep.
So if you wouldn't mind, if there's any other point you wanted to make about a potential solution or anything like that, we can take that, or if that might be Amy's question,
okay.
Just to try to keep things on track. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. I can kind of wrap things up with there are some solutions that are coming out and we're an industry that can really thinks out of the box constantly. We're trying to reinvent ourselves. So one of the things that's been expanding outdoor seating, places that have large parking lots, being able to maybe close off some of the spots that are around the building for outdoor seating. The other, there's other examples of, down the beach, they're talking about, closing down Ocean Boulevard and using that as kind of a pedestrian way and spacing people out and wristbands on the beach and all kinds of stuff like that. But, the bottom line is that some of these businesses just economically are not going to be able to open up unless they get some help. One of the things that we talked about was, we all collect rooms and meals taxes. One of the things that we talked about, we do get for collecting that we do get a small percentage credit from the state for doing it. If that credit actually could go up, that would help us out a great deal. Those are some of the things. But anyhow, I'll take any questions. I have a lot of thoughts, but in this game. But I'll take any questions you have.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. And thoughts that you have around solutions. That you noticed that one of our questions lays that out. If you have more and you would like to submit it back to the committee as they develop, we'd be interested in hearing them. Amy, do you want to lead off a question, or
yes?
Are there other questions?
Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yes.
Great. John, thank you so much for your testimony. It's greatly appreciated. As you all know, I'm also in the hospitality industry. So I did want to ask John to expand on one concept, and that is something that we've been thinking a lot about. And it is this concept that when we do reopen or allowed to reopen, we are going to be required to socially distance or remove, about 75% of our tables or space people at a bar 6 feet apart. Given the fact that, and people, it may not be common knowledge, but, restaurant margins are razor thin. If the restaurant is doing everything absolutely right, maybe you make 10% in a given year, maybe. Maybe a little more if you're super frugal and efficient. But given our razor-thin margins, how do you feel about the what kind of economic support you'd need to bolster through a period of prolonged social distancing required in your restaurants or in your event spaces?
That's an excellent question, and I think that part of the solution is going to be how do we expand our seating capacities efficiently. I think that especially now that we're going into warmer weather, that people that have patios and that can expand their seating off of those patios by having large enough parking lots are going to be okay. They're going to at least get to 50%, which is what we're hoping. But even at 50%, even if we get to 50%, we're going to need 20% of our budget just to cover all the overhead. And that's, we're talking about one restaurant that does $7 million in sales. So think about that number. That's a lot of money. And I think that the state is going to have to say, okay, this year, in order for us to keep these places alive, there's got to be some kind of a substantial outlay based on, I think, A, how healthy, our businesses were to begin with. Because if you weren't healthy to begin with, I don't think you got much of a chance to make it. That's my personal opinion. But it's a great question, it's a really tough one to answer right now. But I would say 20% of operating budget.
Yes, because the overhead, your customer base is shrinking, by mandate, but your overhead remains.
And we've looked at this in seven ways. So Sunday, just personally for our businesses, and said, yeah, we're going to be 20% short.
Yeah. Okay, are there questions?
Fortunately, we have some staying power because we've been in business that long, but that's not going to be the case for a lot of places.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Amy. We will indulge at least one more question. We're almost 5 minutes over. Joe, are there any other questions?
Donnelly, we have one question from Jim Jalbert.
Thank you. That'll be the last question for John. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Donnelly. John, real quickly, and this is not only for you but also for the restaurant industry in New Hampshire in general, if PPP were set up so you could actually use the funds during the first 8 weeks of startup period as opposed to now at shelter in place, would it, A, make a significant business difference for restaurants in New Hampshire, and would it mitigate the need for more funding through, say, like this particular venue through Gopher?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Jim. Yeah, absolutely, it would definitely help if we could, when we got to the point where we could hire the significant amount of our people back and they would be productive, that would significantly help, reduce that 20% number down quite a bit.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Donald.
Yeah.
I'm
no,
all set.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. Interesting question. Okay. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it. I don't mean to cut you short. I'm just trying to be respectful of everybody's time, including the board.
Yeah,
our meetings ended at 3 o'clock, so we want to be able to give everybody an opportunity. But thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's not easy.
I totally understand, and I'm just trying to pitch what really is going on in our industry for those that I've known for a long, long time and have put their life into it and may not get through this.
Understood. With that,
thank you.
You're welcome. We will move on to Dr. Sawyer, who owns Conway Eye Care and Co-op Eye Care. She's also representing, in part of her remarks, Dr. Huffer, who owns a similar practice in the Nashua area. They were my contact, and I'm going to ask my question right at the start and just ask Dr. Sawyer. The members of the committee do not have Dr. Huffer's written response, but they will after today. Both of you have considered some solutions that we find interesting. So if you wouldn't mind taking a few minutes to just give an overview, under 5 minutes of what is happening within your industry That's a little bit different. You made a point in your information about the impact of the unemployment money, if you could touch on that. And if you could then end with some points that are made in the comments about solutions that might be something that would help under question six. So with that, I got all my questions in, and hopefully you'll have enough time to manage this. Welcome. Unless Dr. Sawyer's not there, this is a problem. Joe, is Dr. Sawyer on the phone?
We believe so. Dr. Sawyer, if you could press 5-star on your dial pad and unmute yourself. And again, Dr. Sawyer, that's 5-star on your dial pad. Donnelly, we have Dr. Sawyer
here.
There he is.
Yay, okay. Like, oh, no, I see here all the time.
All right.
Okay.
Hopefully you heard what I asked.
Yes,
or
I
sure.
did. I heard everything.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, yes, I'm Dr. Angelique Sawyer. I am an optometrist and a practice owner in the far north rural New Hampshire. I have a practice in North Conway as well as in Berlin. And I am in our North Conway office today. I'm also the immediate past president of the New Hampshire Optometric Association, and so I'm very involved with optometrists across the state, and we've had a lot of outreach to them, a lot of polling to them. So a large portion of our membership are independent practice owners. However, there are many who are also employees of other optometrists. There are many who are employees of larger medical groups, employees of ophthalmologists, employees of hospitals. So we have, a wide variety of practice modes, some who are employees in commercial settings as well. We have about 210 or so optometrists across the state, and about 180 of those are members of our association. Just a quick, for those that aren't familiar, New Hampshire, doctors of optometry in the state of New Hampshire provide a large percentage of all eye care services to over 1 million New Hampshire citizens, over 2/3 of which need care at least yearly, if not more frequently, for care of chronic conditions, diabetes, blood pressure, cancer, heart disease, all of these things. Many of the times we're diagnosing these through their eye exams. So we're not just talking about, eyeglass contact lens exams here. This is, a major portion of the healthcare system, and we provide a vital service in keeping people out of emergency rooms, co-managing with primary care doctors, and getting the chronic care conditions under control. We have seen quite an impact across the state from the pandemic. I won't go into too much detail because I know you have a lot of my written things there, but everywhere from, a significant decrease in patient volume and lost revenue. Basically, our polling across all of our membership, we're looking at about 80% average loss of revenue across all optometric practices in the state. Some are open for emergency care only, and those practices may be seeing only, a 60 to 70% reduction, but a large number could not even find the way to remain open and to cover the cost of staying open for emergency care, so they have closed completely. And we're looking at about 15% of practices that have closed completely at this point. We are seeing a lot of practices that have had to furlough employees, practices that are having to operate off of their reserve funds, funds that may have been earmarked for equipment purchases, expansions, renovations, things that we, had plans for that are now all being sidetracked. One of the issues that we are seeing that Donnelly mentioned is certainly an issue that we're having in competition. Where we feel that we're having to compete with the unemployment system. Some of the practices that are up and running and continuing to employ our staff are having difficulty having staff come in. Certainly, we want to be respective of those that do not feel safe to be coming into work. However, we are in, you know, low-risk settings. We are taking, you know, extreme precautions to, you know, prevent spread when we do start increasing our volume of care. But just the same, many employees have said in not so many words that it's more profitable to stay home and not work and collect unemployment than it is to come in and to have to work for what they were making previously. And so that's certainly posing a big issue for us to maintain or restore our workforce as we are able to increase beyond just emergency care only. We are having to look at ways to expand our capacity because we're having to maintain social distancing in, you know, small exam settings, eliminate waiting rooms, things like that, increase our sanitizing of our practices. We're going to be looking at a significant decrease in the capacity of patients that we can see when we are able to resume an increased level of care. We've been dealing with, you know, frustration as far as differing input as far as what we should be seeing for care and what should be deterred. You know, we are having to turn away patients who would like to receive their preventative care. But per CDC guidelines, they have recommended all preventative routine eye care be postponed. However, we have not seen that same type of guideline necessarily being upheld in other medical practices. So, for example, in our town, you know, medical practices that are still encouraging preventative and wellness visits and, you know, trying to encourage people to come in for their care, whereas we're having to turn away people that do feel comfortable and want to come in and get the care. If it's not emergent, we have been often turning those away. Let me skip ahead. I think that kind of covers a lot of the main factors. We do have a lot of practices that have received PPP funding, but more than half of them have not received funding. And of course, the scope of what that can cover is limited to payroll. And for those that are getting that payroll now where we're on reduced hours and have less staff and are difficult, having a hard time bringing that staff to come back, many of our practices can't even fully utilize the PPP funds because we don't have the employees returning to work to be able to pay them. So those PPP funds will oftentimes be running out before we're able to open and run at a larger scale, and when we do open and run at a larger scale, we are going to be looking at 4 to 6 weeks of payment lag from third-party reimbursements that we have to wait on claims to be processed to have that revenue coming in again. So that certainly is an issue coming up that we see. Mm-hmm. And bottom line of all of this is that our biggest concern is going to be patient access to care. If we don't have the capacity, if patients can't get in to see us, if we are having to raise our prices in some cases, or perhaps even drop low reimbursing third party plans, unfortunately for a lot of practices, that lowest reimbursing third party plan is Medicaid. And so if we need to make room in schedules to see patients that are going to, you know, result in a greater revenue, that could create a great access issue. So skipping ahead to, you know, some of the proposed solutions, hard to put dollar amounts on many of these, but, you know, some of the things that we have talked about doing is, first of all, additional grants or very low interest loans for these types of independent practices that would cover expenses beyond payroll. We have gotten some Department of Health and Human Service fundings from for those that are Medicare providers, but again, those are very, very small portions. Some of these grants or low interest loans may be geared towards consolidating practices. Some of the very small optometry practices in this state will not survive this. They will be closing their doors, and those patients are going to need to be absorbed by others, other practices. And so if there were some grants or loans available for being able to consolidate and, you know, to combine those practices and the records and the expenses involved in that, that might allow a greater transition of care for the patients of those practices that won't survive this. Another suggested use of funds would be towards payroll assistance specifically for healthcare providers that would incentivize them to return to work instead of staying on unemployment. I know that at the beginning of the call here, there were some specifics as far as how money these funds can and can't be used. And certainly this would be separate from any use of PPP funds, but if there's any way that we can add to payroll to be able to incentivize healthcare workers to return to work and maintain the healthcare force and the access for patients to the care that they need. Another proposal, a major issue that we will see continuing to be probably an even greater issue, is access to PPE, the personal protective equipment. The state is doing a very good job right now of accepting requests for masks and gloves and distributing those to practices that need them, because costs aside, many of our doctors can't even find access to them. We can't get them anywhere, and if you're not affiliated with a hospital or a large healthcare group. So the fact that the state is making those available to us is incredibly helpful. We certainly need that to continue if it reaches a point that we have to be purchasing more of these PPE gear. First, we want to make sure that we have access to it, but if we are having to incur a greater cost, having some grants or funding for the reimbursement of PPE purchases is certainly a possibility for using these funds. Another consideration would be grants towards the reimbursement of telemedicine costs. Many of eye care providers prior to this had not been very involved in telemedicine. In fact, many third-party payers exclude optometry from being able to provide telemedicine care. And so, fortunately, the governor's emergency orders have allowed us to become much greater role in that. I provide probably 3 telemedicine visits per day for red eyes and infections and things like that that are keeping people out of primary care offices and able to get their care from home. But we did not have the means to do this, so we've been scrambling to implement telemedicine. And if we're allowed to continue doing this going forward, there will be expenditure for more secure platforms. You know, we can't continue to use FaceTime and non-HIPAA secure measures for such telemedicine going forward. And then finally, the last thing I want to mention as a possible use of funds is towards public awareness. And again, this, I don't know if this would fall under relief or more of a stimulus plan down the road, but as things continue to improve and we reach a greater area of safety, there will be many patients who continue to be afraid and who, particularly as far as eye care is related, they will neglect their eye care. Many of the chronic conditions that we care for don't cause symptoms until it's far too late. And many patients believe that if they don't get there, if they don't have symptoms, they don't need to be seen and it can be put off. And so as it becomes safer and we're encouraging people to resume their care, perhaps some funding towards public awareness to resume their eye care so that these chronic conditions can be addressed before they become a greater issue. I'm probably over 5 minutes, but I think I covered everything. Did I miss anything asked about, Donnelly?
No, you covered everything. So I just wrapped questions right into yours. So there's actually a whole 2 minutes left if any other board members have questions. But you did great. This is what we're faced with. This is one of the other challenges that is probably in other fields, and these are solutions. So thank you. Joe, are there other questions?
Donnelly, I believe we have a question from Michelle.
Thank you. Michelle?
Hi, thank you, yes. And thank you, Dr. Sawyer, for your testimony. It really helps educate us into the lay of the land. I just had a general question in regards to sort of the financial position or the status of these small optometric practices prior to COVID. I'm in healthcare as well, understand the Medicaid reimbursement rates and so forth. So
yes.
I was just wondering, what do these optometric practices look like before COVID, given the nature of the healthcare industry?
Yeah, there certainly is, you know, a large range across the state. Dr. Huffer, who also contributed feedback, is in a large group with, I think they have 6 or 7 optometrists, very successful, they're growing. In fact, they had been looking at acquiring additional locations. They had been looking to bring in more equipment, do more renovations. I'm, you know, way up north, but up here we also had been looking to grow. I'm bringing in another doctor, and so a lot of these practices have been growing. We're seeing an increase in care as the baby boomers are you know, aging. There's a greater need for eye care for that demographic. There are, you know, a small portion of very small optometric practices across the state, 1 or 2 providers, you know, very few employees who were not well positioned prior to this, who were still on paper records and not electronic records, who, you know, were doing enough to, you know, bring home their paycheck and not necessarily looking to grow or looking to expand and keep up with the times, and those are the practices that we expect are going to not make it through this.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, thank you so much, Dr. Sawyer. I appreciate all the time that you gave to us today and compacting it in a small period of time. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We'll move next to Donna Hajar, the president of The Learning Path, which is a child care center, and Al Letizio is her contact. Al, if you want to do something similar to I just did in order to keep us on track with time, that'd be great. Otherwise, we can let Donna just get started.
And yeah, Donna,
sure.
This is Bill. This is Bill. This is Bill.
Hello,
everybody.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yes. Hello.
All right. Donna, this is Al. Hey.
Hi, Al.
Before you get started, you know, you operate two child care centers, and you do a great business. We were talking about this, and I was surprised to hear how many child care centers there are in New Hampshire. Can you share with everybody how many child care centers there are, and have you spoken with some of those folks who are your counterparts in the business, and are you hearing similar things to what you're experiencing from them?
And, Al, are you asking her that in the context of overall? So I don't want to stop the process. I want Donna to have an opportunity to present. But if you had any initial questions like that, so that you can just start, Donna, with that and then move into your presentation. Thank you.
Okay, great. Actually, that's included.
Yeah, I want to allow a context of how many, there are.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, of course. That's included in my presentation, and my presentation is brief. My name is Donna Hajar. I own the Learning Path Child Care Centers. It's been since 1999 that I opened my doors. I have two centers, one in Atkinson, which is licensed for 112 children, and my other center I opened 8 years ago in Salem, and it is licensed for 120 children. I have 45 staff members, and I have 165 children currently enrolled. So in the state of New Hampshire, there are 656 child care centers, and right now many are in fear of closing permanently because of the financial loss. They don't have a way to recoup funds. There aren't enough preschools now that we can count on, high-quality preschools to boot. So losing any centers to closure is a disaster. I know my child care center, I have been struggling since mid-March financially when the public school district closed, and I lost many, many public school teachers' children. And then that just started the fear of other people withdrawing children, even if they were working. They just worked at home with their children, and they were just afraid to leave the home with their own children. The child care center industry sector, we are the real example of what a small business truly is. Um, 21 years of financial stability up till now, but since mid-March, I leave really with $0 in my operating account. Prior to closing, our enrollment was at full capacity. Parents are working, both parents are working, and we had a lengthy waiting list. And I don't know where that leaves us once we reopen, if we even can. We're waiting for the governor to decide when to lift the stay-at-home declaration, and then we'll decide. We're hoping June 1st, maybe, but we don't know. And once we do open, we're pretty sure that it's going to be a slow start to recover. Our last week of being open was March 23rd, so we closed end of day on March 27th, but we had 15% of our students attending those last 2 weeks of being open. So it doesn't, you know, it didn't reopening with those numbers, it doesn't qualify for the financial piece of it. I couldn't cover payroll with that. I couldn't cover my expenses with just 15 to 20% of our students attending. We are a valuable part of this community. Preschools are well needed throughout the country. 75% of preschools have closed throughout the country due to this virus and due to the financial distress that is put on us. Many centers have stayed open. They have applied for the PPP grant. My company was not eligible because I closed 2 weeks prior to the date you had to stay open, I believe, for 8 weeks. Since February, I was only open for 6. But my staff was frightened to work. And they're frightened to come back. And also, they're getting unemployment, all 45 of them, and they're making more money collecting than they will when they come back to work. So that $600 stipend is almost hurting the economy rather than helping. Does anyone have any questions? I wanted to keep it brief.
Thank you, Donna. I appreciate it.
Yes.
You did exactly what we asked, that 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons that you're on the agenda today is a reminder to people that child care is also a business and that businesses need child care in order to do their work. What percentage of your children have working parents? And of those working parents, what percentage approximately are essential workers?
We only care and educate children on a full-time basis. We don't offer part-time, so every one of our families are working families. So essential workers, I would say probably 30 to 40 parents, 30 to 40
so,
children.
So did they end up finding emergency child care when you weren't able to have enough staff to continue to provide service to those 30 families?
It was interesting because when we closed and we let the parents know and we gave them, you know, 2 or 3 days notice, every one of them said, you know what, we'll just go to our plan B. Thank you for staying open as long as you did. We understand why you're closing, but we'll just go to plan B. So the parents that I've spoken to, they're kind of tag teaming working and staying home. Staying home with the children. Also, some of my teachers are now in the homes of the children and, I guess, babysitting while the parents are off to work. So it has worked out, but I am getting, you know, some parents do want us to reopen because they don't have, it's difficult. Difficult working from home with a two-year-old and a four-year-old in tow.
Understood. Mm-hmm. Al, I didn't mean to jump on in on you. Al, did you want to ask any other questions before we open it up again?
No, I was going to talk to the whole issue of the essential workers because, you know, Donna, like everybody who's spoken today who are business owners or trying to run a business, they're not used to having their hand out to ask for help. They're just not even wired to even talk that way. But one of the things that we everybody needs to realize is that when you have unemployment insurance, essentially that's been a safety net for individuals, for workers. They're able to get their income replaced. And in the case that Donna just mentioned, their income placed plus the $600. But what's been really there's been no safety net like that for businesses like we've heard of today, and including Donna's. So I think it's great to hear you speak and have us all be reminded of that. Great job, Donna.
Thank you, Al.
Thanks,
but Donna Lee, I do appreciate you mentioning that child care centers are a legitimate business. You know, we have payroll. I have teachers who have their associate's degree, their bachelor's degree, their master's degrees. You know, we pay our quarterly business tax and liabilities insurance, and we are a legitimate business. So I appreciate you saying that because I think sometimes it's forgotten that we are a valuable part of the community with the money that we spend just to stay open.
Well, a lot of us believe you are essential, so thank you.
Thank you.
Other members of the board that have questions? Joe, anybody?
Yep, Donna Lee, we have a question from Kathleen Reardon. And again, just 5-star. And real fast, I apologize, but just if anyone's joined us, this is a meeting of a stakeholder advisory board. This meeting is being recorded. And go ahead, Kathleen.
Donna, thank you for taking the time today. I had a question. You know, obviously, child care businesses rely on the funds from you alluded to having both some funding from the state as well as parent tuition. We've heard from some of the other folks who presented today about how social distancing will sort of impact their viability in the future. I was just curious if you have a sense of that when you are able to move forward and open. I think childcare, as you said, is going to be so important to our workforce to be able to go out and work. But how are new standards going to impact your business?
Kathleen, unfortunately, the standards are different than any other industry because how can you social distance yourself from preschoolers and infants? It's impossible. But what we were doing before we closed the last 2 weeks that we were in business, and I know child care centers that remain open, they're taking children's temperatures at the door, and the child must be fever-free in order for them to attend for the day. We're not allowing adults into the building, so those temperatures are being taken in foyers or out in the walkway or in those sorts of things. But I do believe the state is now talking about child care teachers, preschool teachers, may have to start using masks, but children are not going to be using masks.
Thank you. That's helpful. So it's, you know, there may be some additional costs and there's some additional potentially changes in your business practices.
Yes. There already has been, and I do know parents are concerned about teachers wearing masks. They don't like the look of it. But again, it's about safety. And some of my colleagues that I've spoken to, some parents do not want their child in the same classroom as a parent of a healthcare worker. They want those children separated, which I think is, inconsiderate and very, very
Sad.
Not as,
impossible.
No, yeah.
Hard
to staff, yes, but it's just too emotional for a small child to be separated from his peers because
right.
his mom
How
is
do you explain
a doctor.
That?
Because his mom is a nurse. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So, but I don't think we are going to be doing that.
I didn't know if there would be like a change to the classroom size and that would have a larger financial impact.
Yes, there already has been a change to the classroom size. They're saying no more than 10 children in the classroom. That's including the teacher. So if I have a room that's licensed for, 12 pre-Kers, I cannot have 12 children in there. I can just have 10. I can have 9 with a teacher. So there's a loss in revenue that way as well.
Thank you.
Good point. Thank you, Kathleen. Good point. Anybody else have a question for Donna?
We have a question from Holly.
Thank you. Donna, thank you for your presentation. I just have a question. I think you bring up an important point about the unemployment disincentive. Even when you're allowed to open, do you have an idea of how the disincentive will elongate your recovery curve because you won't be able to take as many children if you can't get your staff back?
That will determine whether I can even reopen, depending on how many teachers come back. And if there are any funds available to, for child care centers, I may have to increase salaries to get my staff to come back.
Thank you.
Another good point. Any other questions?
And I think the child care industry is a lower-paying hourly wage, as well as retail, as well as the restaurant industry. So that it's going to be, I think, it's going to affect more than just the child care industry.
Absolutely. Social services you can add to that list, too.
Yeah.
And I bet you Michelle on the board would say, and some of the health care workers. Further questions from anybody on the board?
I think we have a follow-up question from Kathleen Reardon.
Okay. Kathleen?
I think the hand was lowered. So.
Okay. All right. Donna, thank you again so much. Any other point you want to make in your last 23 seconds?
I just want to thank you all for hearing me out and including the child care sector in the questioning. And thank you for your efforts as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, we are going to move on to Justin Slattery from the New Hampshire Alliance of Regional Development Corps. And Justin's contacts from the board are both Nancy and Ben. Justin?
I have a question. Yeah, this is Nancy. I think, Justin, before you start, or Laurel and Jack, I was wondering if you have an estimate of the RDC losses from the COVID and in terms of the number of forbearance or deferrals you've had to do on loans. That's question one. And question two, we just heard from John Tinios, and one of his recommendations was to extend the PPP for 6 months, give the businesses the ability to use a portion for other than payroll. Assuming that the federal government does not extend the PPP, is this what your program that you've described in your written comments would propose to do? So those are my questions.
Thank you, Nancy.
This is Ben. I had a similar question to Nancy's regarding how the loans would complement the PPP loans that are existing. So I think that's a dovetail question to Nancy's questions. And I have a couple others, but I'll let them get started.
Thank you. Justin? Or Jack? Or Laurel? Whoever's going to speak, now's your time.
We have them dialed in, Donnelly. Justin, or anyone from the economic development folks slated to speak, if you could hit 5-star. Again, 5-star. Your line might be muted on your end. Go ahead, Justin, and the RDCs.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Yes.
Yeah. My apologies. Good afternoon, everyone. I've been listening to the meeting, and when it became my turn, I was having a hard time unmuting myself, so my apologies. My name is Justin Slattery, and I am the Executive Director of the Belknap Economic Development Council, and I also currently serve as the Chair of the New Hampshire Alliance of Regional Development Corporations. We are a longstanding network of 10 nonprofit regional economic development organizations, which work in every community in the state, and really have a basic goal and mission to support our businesses and communities through providing technical assistance, financing, and economic development services. As was mentioned earlier, I'm joined by Jack Cuddy, who is the Executive Director of the Mount Washington Economic Development Council, and Laurel Adams, who is the president of the Regional Economic Development Center of Southern New Hampshire. I'm going to have them get more into the details of our response to your questions, but wanted to note as well that we work with many partners, both at the federal, state, and local level, you know, on a daily basis to support economic development in the state and you know, obviously very challenging times really something unprecedented that we've really never seen before in New Hampshire. But we stand ready as organizations working in our communities, working in our regions to assist our businesses and our businesses work through this. And we'll work through this together. And we greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And we know you have a long agenda. So I am going to ask Jack and Laurel to get more into the details of our responses, and we look forward to discussing with you all in the coming minutes.
Jack and Laurel, your lines are good to go.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. This is Jack Cuddy from the Mount Washington Valley Economic Council, and I just want to really thank the committee, the board, to having allow us to do this presentation. And I'm like to keep it quite a short. I've listened to all the presentations over the last hour, and I can tell you that everything that you heard, I have heard in my community. I'm sure Laurel has heard the same. We're all dealing with those same issues. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail only because I feel as though that the response that we provided with you has a lot of good opportunity for you to ask questions of us. Laurel, do you have something to add to that?
Sure. Well, I'll just kick off with my answers to the committee's initial questions and then turn that back to you for your answers, Jack. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for your time. I will endeavor to be short because I know you're running a little bit behind schedule. As of now, REDC is losing approximately $15,000 a month in interest income from clients. I expect that to rapidly increase as we are seeing our second and then third wave of requests for deferrals, most of those clients not being involved in an SBA program and not receiving that payment relief. So we could be looking at a $30,000 a month deficit in short order. Something else, you know, to note, we've helped, REDC has helped about 300 clients through the EIDL SBA disaster loan process and the PPP program process, a combination of loan and technical assistance clients. Of those 300, we're keeping in kind of constant contact with them with surveys. Only a handful have received money yet. And as we are now several weeks into this, particularly, you know,
hospitality, hair salons, daycares, medical practices, entertainment venues, wedding venues. These people, their revenue has dropped to nothing in most cases. So they're really in critical shape for loans. As of today, even an update from when you received our response, I've got about 25 disaster loans in the works using about $700,000 for some of our current clients. And that will exhaust the funds we have for this type of use. And I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm just hoping it bridges people until some of the federal funds come in, and there's going to be a whole other need that we've detailed here once those funds, some of which are still fairly inflexible, are exhausted. Jack, I'll hand back over to you, so if you want to answer the lost questions and then take others.
Hi, Nancy. The total loan forbearance, we have about 600. The network itself, all the 10 RDCs, we have about 600 loans in the portfolio to small businesses. And we all probably immediately sent letters out to our customers as soon as this was, the COVID was raising its hand on and the communities, and offered forbearance on those portfolios. So with that, we are losing, as Laurel says, we're probably losing $6,000 to $8,000 a month in our portfolio in interest. We have about 27 loans out there, totaling $1.5 million as far as existing portfolio. And I just want to talk quickly to show you the effectiveness and the quick response that the RDCs have in the communities to provide the help that they're going to need as we move forward. My board, we were lucky enough to get a RMAP grant in December that I was sitting on. It was about $500,000. And we were able to, as soon as this thing started, I went to my board and said, we need to use this money to support these small businesses because they're not getting the PPP yet, and they're going to need to have some sort of a reserve that they can rely on to get started with as things move forward. And they agreed 100%. The loan portfolio and the explanation on Schedule B in the response that we gave you basically is similar to both what Laurel and I both did for those customers. What we did is we did small loans, $25,000 loans. We did $580,000. We turned out in 2 weeks, and that's with a loan committee that are volunteers. I have 8 people on my loan committee. They reviewed things. We spent the day going over each loan. We deliberated. We had a contract with the our attorneys that we have to do the documentation, and we moved forward, and we were able to do that in a 2-week period of time. We can do that. That's what we do best. That's our niche. And that's why we're asking for the monies that package has. We are the only ones in the state, our network is the only one in the state that really works in small business world, smaller loans, and we partner with other organizations for bigger loans that are going to be for companies that are in need for a lot larger dollars than we have. We share a lot of gap financing with the banks, and we certainly work with BFA and CDFA. So those are the types of things that we can do, and I think our response shows that in our response. So, and we'd be more than happy to answer any questions for you.
Thanks very much. We appreciate it. Nancy, Ben, did either of you want to have follow-up? Ben, I think you mentioned you had one.
I guess from a follow-up on that, you mentioned that there's still outstanding loans that haven't been filled. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what's outstanding, or is there a waiting list of people applying for loans at this stage?
It's funny you asked that, Ben. We were asked. I got emails today asking if we have any money's left in our loan portfolio to reserve to lend. And I explained that we're trying to find some more money through the loan fund to do that. I can probably get rid of, or not get rid of, but be able to loan out at least 100 loans to these companies. Everything your speaker said before is what we're looking at, and those are the questions we're getting asked. The PPP, the problem with the PPP, some of the restaurants are going to have to, what they're talking about up here anyway, is to be able to reduce the grant money that's the forgiveness part of the PPP and offer that as a stipend to get their employees back when the time comes that they need to. But now you have to have that extension in order for that to even work. So we could put out $1 million, we could put out $2 million, we could put out $3 million in a very short time. We're talking about 100 loans at $50,000 a loan. There's not anybody else. The banks aren't going to do that, and none of the other organizations have the ability to push that much out. And that's just the facts. It's not even a makeup type of number.
Right, and I know in our community, the Mount Washington Valley area, is a lot of tourism, but it's my understanding there's a lot of diversity, like you had mentioned, on the loans, the loan types. It's tourism businesses, but it's other types of business as well, isn't it?
Correct. The 27 loans that we put out were hospitality, lodging, child care, outdoor maintenance to get started. The whole nine yards of what travel and tourism is in the Mount Washington Valley. The economic engine that drives the valley is the multiple different businesses that you just referred to.
Great. Thank
you. Can I just add something regarding our clients here in the South?
Yes.
I want to know, you know, I'm having the same hard-hit industries that Jack is mentioning, but we're also hearing from our manufacturers that they're way down. For example, we have a paper tube manufacturer, and you would think with the demand for toilet paper that they would be very busy, but their contracts are down 60%, and that's just not something that a startup can sustain for any amount of time. One of my first calls I got was from a startup hardscape and landscape company that had the first week of the stay-at-home order, so March 14th, 50% of his spring hardscape project canceled because of market uncertainty, and you know everybody's watching their portfolios drop. So it's really, the ripple effect is hitting almost every industry and business that we work with.
Thank you.
Let's see.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's no other network of nonprofits in that knows the business communities like the RDCs do. I just want to emphasize the fact that we're in the community. We are on nonprofit boards. We are in elected official positions at some instances. And we know our business community. That's a key element in being able to address the needs that are going to be that we're going to all be dealing with immediately.
I had a question, Donna, a follow-up. This is Nancy. I really appreciate the detail you've laid out in the Appendix B. I get a real sense of what it is you would do with funding. But I guess this is a question for you, Donna Lee, or perhaps for Attorney Smith. On the guidance for grants, I'm trying to still figure out how that guidance works where the grant becomes a lending vehicle. And how do we deal with that December deadline? So that's a question hanging out there.
I don't think Nancy is still on the line, but it's certainly something we could add to the list that we've asked Lisa about. But as it relates to the, at least the payroll protection money, I feel pretty confident to say that you get the funds, you use the funds as they've been told, a certain percentage in each of the categories related to that. You submit your information that demonstrates that you did as instructed, and it then becomes forgiven.
Right.
If you ended up using it for something else, it then becomes a loan that you begin to have to pay back.
So the Appendix B that was provided by the RDC on their loan program outline has a two-year forgiveness, 50% on the remaining loan balance. So that's really sort of what's driving my question. Is it the grant itself before December 30th, potentially to the RDC, or how are we dealing with that on the federal compliance side? If they're not
That's
putting
a good
it
question.
Out, yeah, right away. So.
All right. Well, I'll run it up the flagpole to the Gopher staff and see what we can get back for an answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Michelle and Bill.
Okay. Michelle?
Sure. And this will be really quick because that was exactly my question about the compliance proposed program. So you've already got it on your to-do list, so I'm all set, and I'll hand it over to Bill.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Bill has an answer. So, Bill?
No, I thank you very much. I think I heard Attorney Smith saying she's still wondering about that. And so the Gopher staff, I heard in her remarks, they're still thinking about how the loan process works and the expenditure by the state to, say, an RDC. That's clearly an expenditure, but the question is there some second-level requirement that applies to RDC? And I didn't hear that the Gopher team had come to an answer yet. But my question for the team of RDC, which did a great job preparing materials, is there's been a lot of controversy in the PPP program, at least, about larger, much larger, you know, even publicly traded businesses getting access to funds before smaller businesses. And do you think that given the way you know your communities, is there some, you know, mechanism that you can imagine that would, you know, specifically allocate first dollars towards much smaller businesses or smaller loans and then maybe scale up? Or how would you address that, making sure that smaller businesses get money? Thank you very much, Donnelly.
Welcome.
Laurel, do you want to take that or do you want me to?
I'll start and then maybe you can close it out. So of the 10 RDCs, these are the businesses that we already naturally serve. We lend to businesses that cannot get some or all of their funding from banks. So we're already dealing with businesses that are on kind of the outside of that. Having lived in this world through the last recession, I imagine that bank lending will tighten even more after this. So I think they will naturally self-select into businesses that are looking for the kind of help that we've outlined here. A large, sophisticated business is not going to want to go through the trouble to get a $100,000 maximum loan out of an organization like ours. And that's why we put that limit on there, and with the average loan size of $50,000, that's not going to support an organization with hundreds of employees. So I think it will self-select itself. And Jack, if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I think it's important that we had smaller businesses in mind for this whole program. And in my experience in the last month where we put those monies out, our average loan was $25,000 and for the small businesses. And a lot of them had applied for the EIDL program. A lot of them had applied for the PPP. But they still wanted to have the ability to have us do a smaller amount of money for them so they could keep it in reserve. And I think that gave them some satisfaction and some relaxation in the beginning. But because of our economy, I know that there are going to be a huge need for the reopening of the Mount Washington Valley as far as inventory for the retail stores and the startups of the restaurants. We have 52 restaurants in the Mount Washington Valley area, and a lot of them were closed. So they have all the startups they can do. The PPP isn't going to help them with that. And the only other area they can get it from is either through loans or if we have the ability to do a program like we're doing, which would be beneficial to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else questions? We're about 5 minutes over our time. Not to scare any of you, there's anything burning.
We have a question, okay. Donnelly, from Jim Jalbert.
All right, Jim.
Yeah, real briefly. I mean, we've had some conversation that wrapped around PPP quite a bit, and I brought it up earlier. And I know that while they just refilled the bucket, there has been a lot of discussion. The governor wrote letters to the delegation into Washington, and there's been a lot of other people that have been starting to get engaged with the idea that you need PPP during startup, and that the rules, while the concept is great, the rules don't fit for a lot of businesses. And I just think whether it's through the people who spoke here today or whether it's through or even us to a limited degree, we need to convey the fact that a couple of rule changes, one being that they extend the startup for the use of the funds for compensation, be moved out closer to mirror the startup of opening or the opening up of states, and two, that they sort of take a hard look at what the government did with the airlines and allow it to go out for 6 months. This would be very helpful, and it would lessen the need to dip into the pot that we're talking about right now and allow us to further spread the dollars out. And, Donnelly, I'll leave it there.
Any of you want to comment on that from the development group?
Yeah, the only thing that I would say is that the PPP, the way it's funded, the 25-75% differentiation, doesn't allow the restaurant, even though the restaurants can get the forbearance or the forgiveness by having the employees come back in that six-month time frame, that still doesn't help the business itself in being able to get the necessary items to reopen. The inventory, the materials, the staffing that they have to retrain, the collateral materials that they have to put into place, the marketing that they're going to have to do to get reopened and get those customers back. So, yeah, it would help with the PPP, would certainly help the payroll aspect of it and paying the employees, but it doesn't give them the opportunity to refinance, or not refinance, but have the ability to pay for all the other things that need to be part of that reopening.
No, but I guess my point in all of that is that if that's part of the solution, more people can benefit from what we're doing. So if the compensation issue can be taken care of, and it's not only limited to restaurants, it's attractions, it's every other thing that you all are involved with, we can do more.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, okay, thank you. I'm going to stop questions there because we're almost 10 minutes over now. And I'm going to open it up, and I'm going to thank you all for participating and staying on the call this long to be able to share your insight.
Donnelly,
very much appreciated.
Donnelly?
Yes, Bill?
Donnelly, I think BFA is still there.
Oh, no, I know. I was just thanking the Regional Development Group. That's all right. And so, again, thank you. And then we'll move on to James Key Wallace, who is getting used to presenting quite often. And I think you clearly have seen the method that we're trying to work with, and your contact spoke up to make sure that we did not forget that you were here. So we'll open it up. The floor is yours.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Donna. Can everybody hear me okay?
Think so.
Good. All right. Well, good afternoon. My name is James Key Wallace, and I'm the Executive Director of the New Hampshire Business Finance Authority. I recognize that we're over time today, so I'll try to be as brief as possible while going through all of the points. I don't intend to rehash everything that was provided in written materials, but certainly happy to take detailed question. So I'd like to start just by, for those that don't know, just saying a little bit about who the BFA is. So the Business Finance Authority, we're the state's Economic Development Finance Authority. And our mission is to ensure that small businesses and nonprofits across the state of New Hampshire have access to credit so that they can operate their business, grow, and create jobs, all with the idea of having a healthy economy that takes the marriage of private activity and turns it toward the public good. So we were created almost 30 years ago, actually out of a crisis situation. In the early 90s, many of you probably remember, there was the savings and loans crisis. Well, it started in the late 80s and came into the 90s. And back then, a lot of companies were shut out of credit in that case due to a failure in the financial system that prevented New Hampshire companies from getting their loans. And so the BFA was created in order to help make sure that when times are tough, that the pain doesn't run too deep. So for ever since then, you know, we have been a very effective steward of these programs. We operate, we're part of the state, but we operate independently from the state. We've now helped over 5,000 New Hampshire companies. Most of those are small companies, including nonprofits and sole proprietors. But then we've also helped support major projects. We were the driving force that brought Albany Saffron, that plant into Rochester. We did a big investment that got the advanced tissue manufacturing done for the Gorham paper and tissue plant. And we were the financing arm behind BAE's expansion into Manchester. So we run the gamut from, you know, a sole prop, you know, individual business to one with, you know, thousands of employees. And, you know, what we've seen over the last, you know, number of weeks now is no different than anybody else. It's just, it's widespread economic disruption. You know, in the past few weeks, we've received requests for over $45 million in financing. That's over 150 different businesses and nonprofits. And those are the folks who can't get help from PPP. Or have already got help from PPP, but need capital for additional things. So, you know, I'm happy to tell you any more about what that demand and the economic disruption looks like, but you've probably heard quite a bit about it. So my goal in this presentation is to do three things. You know, one is to provide a specific framework and the mechanisms that Gopher could use to deliver relief to small businesses and nonprofits. Two, I want to illustrate how the BFA can be an effective vehicle for helping deploy those funds, both directly and through our partners like the banks and like the RDC network you just heard from. And three, talk a little bit about the legal and reporting structure that would be put into place to ensure that all federal requirements are met, and that the process has transparency and oversight. So those are the three things. And the overarching goal behind the plan that the BFA has put forward is really to provide relief, right? So the money that's in this plan we've talked about is not enough to replace all the lost revenue or make everybody whole. I just don't think that's possible with the funding, even $1.25 billion. It's really just about providing relief funds to keep businesses and nonprofits solvent and alive so that way they can survive and the recovery is more robust once it begins. And it's our belief that the most effective and efficient way to do that is by delivering funds via existing trusted institutions across the state. The BFA is just one that has programs that are proven, they're ready to go, they have partnership networks that can help deploy capital quickly, but not in a sloppy manner. And to give a little background on the BFA and our experience in this, so we have a lot of experience with small businesses, the capital markets, loan programs. In the past, during the 2008 to 2012 financial meltdown, that the BFA was the recipient of substantial federal funding from a program called SSBCI, which was the State Small Credit and Business Initiative. That was federal money that came through the state into the BFA specifically to provide relief to small businesses and nonprofits who were in a very similar situation as they are today, but for very different reasons. They were in hardship. And so that program came with extensive reporting and data, you know, tracking all the every dollar which went to what organization and, you know, what they used it for, how they paid it back, you know, creating mechanisms that say, here's who should get the money and here's how you test that to make sure the money's going to the right people. And all those frameworks exist. So, you know, one of the areas that I think are important to note is whatever system that the state decides to put into place has to be ready, I guess, ready to be what I'd call stress tested. And for all the great impact PPP has had, I think for every good story that's out there who it's helped, there's a frustrating story of someone that it hasn't. And a lot of companies, as you know, have been shut out. But also there have been glitches and bottlenecks and frustration with the process itself, trying to get so much money out through one institution all at the same time. I think that's a lot to ask of any institution. And so the programs that I'll detail, you know, please know that the delivery plan for these programs, even if the money that I'm talking about came into the BFA to go to these businesses, much of it would actually be done in partnership with the banking community, the RDC network, and others to spread out the load of the processing of how these loans could get out onto the street. So I'll get into the programs at a very high level, and then we'll be happy to take questions. So there's two main components that I'd like to talk about. You know, one is a fund for business relief that's generally available to any kind of companies. And the second is a larger pool that's targeted precisely to those industries that are most affected by this crisis, which is hospitality, retail, and restaurants. You know, I think there's no mystery as those have been hit the hardest. So a lot of these two programs work in the same way, but I'll illustrate the differences. So under component one, which would be broad business relief packages, that money, a $75 million package, could come into the BFA and then deployed into businesses and nonprofits through three main windows. The first is what's known as our CAP program. The CAP program utilizes the bank's lending network. Almost every bank in the state is a member. We've driven thousands of loans through this program. And the way that it works is if there's a loan that wants to get made, but it doesn't fit the bank box because it's too risky, like in today's climate, the BFA, the borrower, and the bank can all contribute a small amount of capital into a reserve account at that bank. Every time a loan gets made under the CAP program, that account gets a little bigger, a little bigger, a little bigger. And if any of those loans don't work out, the bank has a collateral base to pull from that they can reimburse themselves for the loss. And so what you end up with is the ability for the bank to make a lot of loans based on a high volume of small contributions that get spread around the whole portfolio. So the BFA has deployed about $20 million in CAP funds throughout our history, which has resulted in over $230 million in bank loans being created. So what we would do under this program is increase the amount of contributions into those CAP accounts to help the banks be able to make loans to these companies that need to get through the crisis. That leverages the existing network. It's reusable capital, so it could be lent over and over. So it can help more than one company each time it's deployed. The second function also helps banks lend money, and that's by offering BFA loan guarantees, which is what we're most known for. In this circumstance, capital will be used to set up in reserve to help more types of companies become eligible for loan guarantees. Right now, there are restrictions on how much collateral has to be in place to be eligible for a loan guarantee. By relaxing those restrictions and instead replacing it with capital reserves from this funding, you can open up the universe of types of companies that the banks can lend to that they might not be able to. You'll see a theme here in my presentation is you can get a lot more bang for your buck by taking slices of the money and using that to turn it into much more lending from the private sector. And the third window here is there will be people who can, they'll fall through the cracks, you know, the bank can't help or, you know, just won't work. And so the BFA has existing ability to make bridge loans, which are temporary loans directly to a business for a certain period of time until a bank can come and take over that relationship. But right now, the demand just far exceeds the available capital. So this would be the Catch People Who Fall Through the Cracks program. So those programs would be delivered through banks, through RDCs, and through the BFA for really any business that can show that it's viable prior to the crisis, can demonstrate clearly in their financial statements that their revenues were in fact impacted by COVID-19, and then thirdly, agrees by contract to comply with all federal reporting, data requirements, everything we need the business to do to make sure that it's a proper use of the funds. So I'd like to move now to component two, which includes everything I just said. So it's a lot of the same mechanisms, but in this case, it's targeted toward the industries that are most hurt, those ones that I mentioned earlier, hospitality, retail, and restaurants. The differences here is you'd have the same delivery mechanisms, but you'd put two twists on it. One, you'd ensure that the order in which you would accept applications starts in the small business category first. So people who need loans of, say, $100,000 or under. So you prioritize the funding for those smallest companies, those who are least likely actually to be able to get help from PPP and other sources. You get all those in the door and you process those, look at how much funding is left, and then say, okay, now medium-sized companies, you come in. Get all those done. Is anybody still left? Any money still left? Then you could say, okay, now it's open to anyone. So you would almost flip the script on how PPP worked and really prioritize local small businesses and nonprofits in New Hampshire. The other twist that's special to the targeted funds is a loan forgiveness piece. The industries that are really badly hit by this, especially the small organizations, they're just not going to be able to borrow their way out of the crisis entirely. So we would propose that up to 50% of the loan that gets made is forgivable with a maximum of $50,000. And so what that does is it leaves some skin in the game for the business, that it's not just a grant, it's not just free money. They do have to pay back part of it, but it also recognizes how hard they've been hit and makes up to half of it forgivable for those small loans. And the way you structure that is you say, okay, here's a loan for, we'll say, $100,000. $50,000 is forgivable. $50,000 is not. You advance the whole $100,000 based on the eligible criteria.
Yeah.
They pay back the $50,000, and once they've done that, and they've satisfied all their obligations for federal reporting compliance, you then turn around and say, great, met the criteria, your remaining $50,000 is forgiven. The $50,000 of forgiveness is a huge amount for a small business, but it's not so much that a big corporation that is looking for millions of dollars is going to try and apply just to get $50,000 in forgiveness. So it targets the grant aid to people that need it the most. Those would be delivered through the same network, some direct BFA, some via the banking network, and then some via the RDC network. So that's a very high level of how the program would work. All the details are in the documents. And then the last piece I would like to touch on is the legal and sort of kind of mechanical structure between the state and the BFA. So this has been done before. When the state authorizes an entity like the BFA or somebody else to administer programs on their behalf in this case, what happens is there's a contract that gets executed between the state and the BFA that says we are expending this money, and it's recorded as an expense in the state, goes to the BFA, and says you will use this money in the following way. These types of companies, this type of parameters, this type of approval process, you must report all this data. You'd be willing to do whatever is required, report to whatever body into we'd be, you know, able to report into the state for whatever ongoing compliance and reporting the state wants, as well as being able to report out to the federal government. So all of that is in a contract, and then those similar requirements are then passed on to the every business or nonprofit or delivery partner for the money. That way there's integrity across the entire process. And so this is something we've done, you know, before. Actually, all those documents are still on file. They'd have to be retailored for this particular situation, but it's not new ground. And we'd be happy to help. So I thank you, and that's the end of my presentation, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Bill, as the contact, did you want to lead off on any clarifications or questions you would like to ask?
Donnelly, thank you. I want to thank James for presenting to the group, but no, I'd like to turn it over to other members. As I've disclosed, we do legal work for the BFA at our law firm, and so I'll leave it to other members.
Okay. Joe, do we have questions from other members?
I'd just like to remind members, 5-star to ask a question. Again, 5-star, just seeing if the system's populating any hands up. We have a question from Dean.
Thank you. Dean?
Thank you, Joe. James, great job, and I love the leveraging in your proposal. I just want to be clear a little bit more about the dollar amounts here and sort of the basis of those. You mentioned in your earlier comments the large amount of requests that you had already received. So could you just walk through how the two pieces were allocated and how you got to the dollar amounts in each case that you would recommend for each phase, if you will, each component?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Dean, and good to talk to you. So the $75 million for the first phase is based on what we've experienced just in requests, right? So we have $45 million in requests now. That's without any announcement that the BFA has a special lending program for COVID-19-related effects. I have no doubt that number would go up substantially when that happens. So 75 is a guess based on 45 we've seen to date and my extrapolation of what might come. It probably won't be adequate, frankly, for everybody, but I also recognize there are a lot of priorities for this money, and you know, I'm not going to come and say it should all go to the BFA or necessarily all go to small business.
Sure.
The second part, the $250 million, that's not a BFA recommended amount, so I'm glad you asked. That is a reaction to what I heard in the past, I would say, week or so of presentations to this group and Gopher's Legislative Advisory Board from the industries like the hospitality industry, retail, restaurants, you know, based on they said, oh, we have this much in lost revenue, but lost revenue doesn't really mean lost profits. It's not a one-to-one correlation. And with the idea of, okay, even if they lost $700 million in revenue, we're not trying to replace revenue. We're just trying to provide survival money for these entities. And so $250 million at $100,000 average loan size is, what, 2,500 loans? I think there are 9,000 taxpayer IDs in those three industries that I named. So, you know, that amount would service, you know, a little less than, you know, a little more than a quarter of the companies if they all applied. So there's a little bit of projection in that math, but that's how it came to be.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, we have a question from Ben.
Ben.
Hi, this is Ben. I just wanted to know if you could elaborate a little more on the partnership with the RDCs you had mentioned.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So there's two primary ways that the BFA would partner with the RDCs, and one is an existing way and one is a new way. So the RDCs are a great network, and they help drive a lot of capital to businesses. I think it is completely accurate when they say nobody knows their local business climate better than they do. So right now, in order to help deliver loans, the RDC network often, when they need to make a loan to a local business, sometimes they have the capital to do that. Oftentimes they don't because they've lent that capital out to other companies. And so the BFA has existing lines of credit established with the RDCs where they actually borrow the money from the BFA and then they go and they lend it on to the small business. So we're a conduit for small business capital through that RDC delivery network. And so that would continue, and that would absolutely be part of the delivery mechanism with these funds to make sure there's a local partner who can identify these folks, they know they're legitimate, and then can have a close, ongoing relationship with them. All the parties in that chain would have to agree to the federal requirements put in place by this money and also any state reporting put in place by that money. But the BFA oversees those lending relationships with the RDCs now, and we'd keep doing that. The second way we would use that network, of course, with their permission, but I would hope they would be on board for this, is we could invite them into the CAP program. And that would be new. And the way that that would work is right now, CAP is run by banks with BFA help. There's no reason in my mind that for these funds for this crisis, the RDC network couldn't play the same role. So if there was a small business, the RDC says, this is a great company, they normally wouldn't qualify, they've been rocked by COVID, et cetera. The BFA could make a contribution into a reserve account held separate that helps secure that loan. So the RDC makes the loan in some place with the capital we put in the account. So the loan can be made, the RDC earns the interest. They know there's a backup if things just don't make it, but the small business gets the loan and the forgiveness piece can be woven right through that. So they would be part of the army that would be needed. I mean, I would anticipate at least 1,000 loans being requested within 30 days. And so I don't, all RDCs, all 10 of them together, can't do 1,000 loans. I can't do 1,000 loans. None of us can. But by the banks, the BFA, and the RDCs together, I don't think there'd be any concerns.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Further questions?
And Donnelly, we have a question from Nancy.
Nancy?
Hi, James.
Hi, Nancy.
Again, I really like with the RDC presentation. I really appreciate all the detail that's in here. It gives us a lot to think about. But I guess it's the same question again, and it may be for Attorney Smith to make sure that if we're looking for recommendations, two recommendations on grants, that we're not going to run into issues with the guidelines. Particularly, as I understand it, James, you've got the one that does offer forgiveness as well. So I think that's the area I just want to make sure we're all in compliance.
Yeah, am I hearing, Nancy, that there's a question of whether or not loans are an eligible use of the federal funds? Is that the question?
Well, I think it's loans and grants, but more importantly, when it has to be out the door. So if the money is not sort of out the door, in a loan by the end of the year, even though it's a grant to you. I just want to feel comfortable that we're not going to run into any compliance problems.
Sure. I think that's a good question. I don't have any significant concerns that we would not be able to get the loans out the door by the end of December.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the demand is there. I think especially once PPP expires officially.
Yeah.
I don't think it's not a particular concern of mine.
It's not an issue. And is the forgiveness on your small business loan on the one we heard earlier from the RDC that kicks in after 2 years, after I guess employment numbers stay the way they were identified at the beginning, when would forgiveness occur with your lending program?
Good question. So I would design my forgiveness differently than what they proposed. I would not tie it to employment. I think one of the frustrations with the PPP program is, you know, there are lots of very valid business expenses that are not employment related, although that's very important too. The way we would do our forgiveness is this. So once you've taken a loan, which part of it is forgivable, you begin to make, after some period of no payments to kind of, you know, no payments during the crisis, right? But once things get back somewhat normal, payments begin on the non-forgivable portion. We'll say it's a $100,000 loan that's split 50-50.
Okay.
So the business begins to pay on the $50,000 of non-forgivable.
Yep.
Once they've hit that $50,000 mark where they paid back the non-forgivable loan, as long as they've A, paid back what they owe, and B, satisfied all the reporting requirements we mandate, and C, have demonstrated that they spent the money on the valid purposes that we outline, then the forgiveness is immediate.
Okay.
You want to do it that way because you want to incentivize the businesses to pay back the non-forgivable parts and ensure compliance with these requirements. If you forgive the money after 2 years or upfront, you know, they can just walk away with the rest or default, and now it's too late.
Yeah.
You want skin in the game, and you want to help companies, but you got to keep them on the hook for their responsibilities too.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
No problem. You're welcome.
Are there further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, we're just taking one final look. It appears that we don't have any other hands raised.
Thank you so much. And James, thank you so much. Your presentation was very thorough. It's helpful to have concrete solutions that you're offering for consideration. And I'm sure that there will be an opportunity for people to learn more from you as we move forward with the process.
Well, thank you, Donnelly.
You.
I'm happy to be a resource for any purpose that you guys may want us to be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, the next item on our agenda is other business. It was meant to be a discussion around what sectors of our economy should be considered for allocations from the coronavirus relief funds. It's really about trying to set up the days ahead for the committee work. You have all been very gracious in trying to give me some leeway to work the schedule in a way that provides information and tries to help us get our arms around different things. Today's design, as you can see, was meant to give a cross-section of businesses, small and large, people that are up to their elbows in doing the work, and then cap it off with two potential ways to look at getting money out the door so that we could kind of think of all of that together. on Thursday, as you know, we're working on a nonprofit day. Kathleen Reardon is working through some of the responses that you've all reached out to get, along with some of the ones that she has gotten, to try to set up a similar day where we would hear from, you know, several nonprofits across sector, and then the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and the Community Development Finance Authority will kind of be the capstone to those conversations. On Tuesday, Dean Christian has gracefully offered to help, as Kathleen has, to set up a housing day to look at, again, a cross-sector of businesses within that realm. And again, then, you know, I've asked Dean to be kind of the capstone there because the Housing Authority really is the one of the major ways that money gets out into that industry in our state. So that gets us a few under our belt, but it also gives us an opportunity to think about, do we want to look at this in a different way? Are there other sectors that we should consider? Are there things that we're learning along the way that we want to dig a little deeper in? Scott Mason had to jump off the call early, but made it very clear to me that, you know, he wanted to be part of this discussion because he wants to try to figure out how to do an agriculture day. You know, food, fiber, produce, New Hampshire, kind of what's happening there, and wants to also talk about, do we want to do a North Country day? And I do understand that the North Country is different. I also think about tourism. There's a whole sector of our state that relies on that might be different than what might be happening in a Nashua or a Concord. So I will open it up for a little bit for people to, suggest the way that they're thinking about this. I also want to let people know that you can reach out to me and tell me about some of your thoughts about the day going forward. I know that we're competing with another meeting that started at 3, so I'm trying to be respectful because we do have members that have dropped off, so they won't be able to participate. But for what it's worth, I would love people to provide some input. 5-star, folks.
Donnelly, we have the first hand raised from Ben Wilcox.
Thank you. Ben?
Yes, I just wanted to do a shout-out to a tourism day. I know we did hear a lot of elements of that today in some of those sectors, but it's really, as mentioned by the BFA and several of the parties, that's an extremely hard-hit category. And so I know there's a lot of important categories, but I think that would warrant a solid day of presentations.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Anybody else? You don't have to have all your answers today. We'll revisit it on Thursday as well.
Don Lee, we have a hand raised from Polly.
Polly?
I would also put in for a healthcare day, long-term care.
Okay.
Did I get disconnected? Yeah.
Nope, I hear
you. Long-term care seems to be significantly impacted. Assisted living, because they didn't get some of the funding that the long-term care did because they were privately paid. I think there's a whole network of elder care maybe, or long-term care, health care.
Okay.
Some sector there.
Great. Thank you.
Donna Lee, we have Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. I was late to the party, having joined this committee after you had one or two meetings. You may have already covered this, and I apologize. But could you just talk briefly about the timing of our recommendations and how the timing works with respect to getting the funding to the businesses that need it?
Well, I can tell you, and anybody else can jump in that may from Gopher if you would like, but we have not yet been told any deadlines, but I think all of us feel the pressure of the money arriving and needing to get out. And that's why it's very helpful to have people, when they're talking, focus on what some of the solutions that they see are, because that can help us to at least maybe make recommendations about where to start or what's already out there that could be used to start getting this out based on the deadlines. I'm hopeful that we'll have, you know, more specific guidance soon. I don't see us having this never-ending supply of weekly meetings and gathering information and then writing a 200-page report on what we think. This is very different, and I don't, you know, we've never really done something quite like this before. As Bill said at our first meeting, this is a huge undertaking, $1.25 billion, when the most the state has ever gotten in under emergency circumstances was $25 million. And when that $25 million came in, I was mayor, and I remember what we were trying to deal with, and it was nothing, nothing like what we're trying to do now. I know that's not the answer that you're looking for, but it's probably the best I have right now. But I'd like us to be able to do our work, and we have to try to fit in time for the committee to discuss the things we're learning. We're probably up to about close to 30 responses that have come in to date, and I'm going to send out a packet to everybody, and I'm sure that we'll get it on the website, of what's come in to date. I didn't want to do it before today's meeting because I didn't want to confuse the packet that went out with today's meeting, but there's a lot coming in, and I think it's important that we try to dig for the solutions. It's important to understand what people are up against, but it's also important to try to figure out, do they have something in mind about a solution? You know, is it something that makes sense? Are there places that can help us get it out? I mean, ultimately, as you know, it's not our decision, but it would be nice to make recommendations.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I just want to piggyback on Holly's recommendation in regards to Health Care Day. She named two very good components of health care, but also the mental health, substance use disorder, home health, hospice, and health and hospitals.
Okay. I think we are looking at trying to have some of those fields represented on Nonprofit Thursday. then I think we can look at, okay, who else was missing. But thank you. Yes.
Will we know in advance who's going to be on the, only
yes,
because I'm getting some
you
of
will.
The responses in healthcare?
Yes, you will. So what I'm trying to do, and, you know, it would have been, in a perfect world, our agenda would have been posted with the packet of information the day before. But, of course, we had to wait to let people get it in. Now we have quite a bit. I've provided some to Kathleen. She's going through them, you know, trying to, again, cross-section. It's our hope that that agenda will be out and posted with the packet of who's presenting no later than noon tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Anybody else, Joe?
Donnelly, doesn't appear that we have any other
okay.
hands raised.
So you all know how to find me. By all means, something crosses your mind that I should be aware of, I would appreciate knowing. And I think the way we set up today worked pretty well. We'll learn from some of the bumps today, but I think we'll get to where we're trying to go. All right. Anybody else have anything under other business?
Just to say thank
all
you,
right.
Donnelly. It was it's 3 hours here, but I think that we got a lot of information out of the people who presented today.
Oh, you're welcome. I think we did too. I think we'll get a rhythm.
Thanks, Donnelly.
Yeah, thank
welcome.
You, Donnelly.
Great job.
All right, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. All right.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
And we are adjourning the Stakeholder Advisory Board for Tuesday, April 28th. Looking at the time, it's 3:55 p.m. This meeting has been duly noticed and conducted in compliance with RSA 91A. This meeting, again, has been recorded. And looking at the time, it's 3:55 p.m., and the recording will end.